Hello and welcome to Cycling Mo, your cycling informant. Back for another wonderful podcast. Today I'm joined by James Knox of the Koenig Quickstep. So James Knox is 24 years old. He is a climbing sensation.
Whoa.
Well, at least he hopes to be. And he's enjoyed a really good season with the Koenig Quickstep, taking in some pretty impressive results. And today we're going to chat through his 2019 season and look forward to 2020. James, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. I'm very good.
Good, good. Okay, so you are currently on team camp.
Yeah, that's right. I'm sat in my hotel room in Calpe. I think so far we've done like 8 or 9 days here, and we've got till the end of the week still here.
What's a team camp like? Go on then, for all those cycling fans that will kind of watch it, we see you kind of rolling around, probably not training that hard, but what's the team camp like? What's the whole kind of week, 9 days like?
Actually, this camp, this December camp's quite a strange one, where it's really, as much as the bike riding, it's doing everything else. We've been really, really busy this year. I know every year is busy, but this year has been even, I'm not going to say crazy, but like we've been on the bike, but then the time we're not on the bike, we've been doing photo shoots. Guys have been doing bike fits, getting shoes, everything set up. But a load of like sponsor related stuff, as well as like health checks with the medical team, discussions with DSs about the race program, talks on it. So every night we sort of finish dinner at 9 p.m. and then have to go and do sort of like could be an hour long, up to 2 hours, some of them, talking with sponsors, talking with, we've had the CDAF, which is like the anti-doping organization, come in and do a talk. We've had the CPA, which is like the riders union, do a talk. So there was a lot going on, like just sort of rider interaction, as much off the bike as then on the bike, and just clocking up some steady hours on the bike, but nothing too crazy, like you said.
How does it feel being one of the more experienced guys, or maybe not the least experienced guy now?
Yeah, I don't know. My mum and dad asked me this, but I still guess I see myself still way down the pecking order, so nothing's really changed in my eyes. I'm still one of the young guys. You know, there's a lot more experience in the team ahead of me, so I'm still trying to keep my head down.
Right, okay, we're going to look back at 2019, but I think for me, we need to just go back a tiny bit into 2018.
Yeah.
Because San Sebastian is kind of where you really, for me, you really kind of laid down the marker of probably where you want to be. Obviously, first year pros really hard, and you go around top races, get your head kicked in, and then eventually San Sebastian. I mean, you finished 19th, which some people might look at that and go, well, you know, that's not great, but you were up there towards the end. Alaphilippe won.
Yeah.
Did it feel like the kind of the moment where you felt, yeah, this is kind of where I want to be?
I guess I got my feeling of that just a few days before at Wallonie. I know it's not the same level as San Sebastian, but I really felt like I was making the race there, which was a huge, huge difference. I know it was a step down going to Wallonie, but I was the guy making the moves. Pretty confident myself as being like one of the top few climbers in that race. And then that was a huge, huge change. So I guess I went to San Sebastian, no real pressure. We were working for Julian anyway, but sort of confident that, yeah, I would sort of start to adapt a bit, should we say. Like, yeah, I had been getting my head kicked in, but really starting to feel like maybe I can ride to this level. And yeah, first it was Wallonie, then San Sebastian. I had little small steps of confirmation that I could sort of get a bit more comfortable at the World Tour level.
And then you went to Tour of Turkey at the end of the year. I think you lost some time on GC. Was there maybe a crash or something? Lost a wheel in one of the sprint stages. And then, I mean, fourth on the Queen stage. I remember you were a bit disappointed. You're a bit kicking yourself.
Yeah, I think I was pretty revved up, but I remember I was just a bit annoyed because it was just block headwind and I didn't really feel like I could let rip. And then it was just a sprint, and obviously the guys were sprinting against a pretty phenomenal sprinters even for climbers, so I was never really going to get up there. But yeah, small steps definitely on a sort of upward trajectory, so can't complain too much.
So you end the season feeling good. You know, you've had some better results towards the second half. So then you head into the winter. What was your winter like? Did it all go according to plan?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a huge stress over the winter. I just do a lot of plodding around, to be honest, just staying on the bike, doing bits in the gym. There's nothing fancy. I didn't change anything. But yeah, I think just a season of racing at that level in the legs and then building back up to it, just, yeah, you're bound to be a little bit stronger.
And you bounce over to Australia, Tour Down Under, Cadell Evans Great Ocean Road Race.
Yeah.
You find yourself in a unusual position for yourself in the Cadel Evans race, where you're trying to control the front with the last, what was it, last 2K, 3K? Attack, and you, I think maybe it was Devonines, who were trying to control the front. That was a different role for yourself to fulfill.
Yeah, I guess prior to that, I'd ridden on the front and helped control stuff, but yeah, not in that real, like, so close to the finish situation. But I was just finding my legs there, actually, at the Cadel Evans race. I wasn't so good in TDU. It was a bit hard, it was a bit hot, and I wasn't really ready for it. But Dries was exceptional that day. I remember that. He followed all the attacks, and I stayed with Elliot, me and Michael. As soon as we came over that final little kicker, I can't remember the names of the hills or anything. It was just sort of, this is it now, Elliot's still here. Get to the front, start riding. And I think someone from, I started riding and I think Van Baal clipped off. I had to just sort of close him down. So I just sort of matched him. And then I think Dries took over and that was it. By the time Dries took over, we were sort of heading to the last like K and a half K. So we basically, the home straight there. I think it was a bit too late for anyone else to get away.
And then it was Morkov to Viviani, and we all know the rest of the story, much like most of the season. Then you head to UAE Tour, and you net your first top 10 in a World Tour race. So you finish 8th overall.
Yeah.
How good did that feel? There was a couple of real kind of tough stages in there. You performed well, you hung in, and then you walk away top 10. Must have been a good feeling.
Yeah, it's a funny race, UAE. I mean, I guess I didn't really enjoy it so much at the time, but the relief of, getting through that, like you say, finishing a World Tour race in the top 10 was a big, big deal. I think my position in the team, sort of the way everyone sort of looked at me, changed a huge amount there as well, you know, actually delivering a good GC result. But yeah, it's strange in the sense that it's 7 days, but it comes down to like two 20, 25 minute efforts. It's everything else is sort of like not worthless, but you just do a lot of floating around, but then you really have to be fit enough to go absolutely eyeballs out for those two climbs. Like, it is really like a 20 minute power test, like you do, you know, it's as hard as it gets. But no, I had the legs there, and I was very happy.
Yeah, and I mean, at that point, do you kind of think about the significance of your first top 10? You know, does it make it a little bit extra special?
Yeah, maybe not the top 10, but the big thing in UAE was just the level of the guys who were there. I'd had some nice results, but UAE was just completely stacked field. It was Roglic, Valverde, I can't remember all the names, but I remember thinking, looking around, like, who I'm rubbing shoulders with here, you know, finishing across the line with, like, Kelderman and Micah and Mollemer and all these guys, thinking, wow, this is a really good place, a good level to be at here.
And your old pal from under 23, Godu, he was there as well?
Yeah, he was a little bit ahead of me, if we're being honest, but he was still there as well.
Then you head over to Catalonia. Final stage is the one that sticks out. You get your ass in the brake, and you're up the road when it all kind of kicks off on the lap circuit, and you were chasing around with both Yateses for a little bit.
Yeah. I went to altitude in Sierra Nevada before Catalunya, and actually arrived at a really good level, but that first summer finish to Valtteri was just crazy, crazy, crazy hard. Again, some of these World Tour races, you think you're at a good level, but then Bernal was there, Quintana was there, Adam Yates was there, and it was just crazy. So I think I finished around 20th on that first big day for the GC. And sort of with the fact that Enrique was further ahead of the GC than me, I think I lost, you know, maybe an extra 30 seconds than he did. We gambled a bit, and I managed to jump in the move on the stage to La Molina. And in the end, the guys from the break did stay away. It was like Soler, Mulberger, and someone else, I believe. But played my hand, sort of got caught a little bit. It was kind of messy up the road, where a lot of guys, I think we looked like, at one point, I think everyone started to think we were going to be riding for the victory easy, and we started attacking with like 60k to go instead of just sort of keeping a bit more cohesion. And then, again, got in that breakaway on the last day, had good legs, and actually was really, really disappointed that Formolo got away on a descent. I don't think it was maybe picked up on the cameras, but he didn't ride away on the climbs or anything. He just got away. He just gets on the top tube and just takes up crazy risks on corners. Got a little bit of a gap, and we couldn't get him back. And then from there, I was in a little trio chasing him. And then the Yateses came across. The Yateses popped the other two guys, Bevin and that guy who's really strong from Aji Dessert. And hung on with the Yateses for like a lap. It was three. In the end, I blew up again and got caught by the next group. But that was really fun, actually. As as days go out, racing, that was about as good as it gets. I was like really in the thick of the action. It was really pretty cool at the time, being there with both the aces, guys I look up to. So yeah, enjoyed that one a lot.
Was there any words when they got across to you? Like, come on, let's do it together.
No, you just sort of get, well, I mean, I was happy to ride with them. It was in my advantage and their advantage. Just, I think it was just a nod, just as English as it, like British nod, just like, yeah, okay, here we go. We're all in agreement. Bit of a nod, let's go. I mean, I couldn't give them a turn on the climbs anyway, so I was just doing a bit of the pedaling on descents and flat bits.
How, I mean, we all know that that stage really well. I mean, the circuit looks super tough.
Yeah.
How hard is it?
Yeah, it is a really tough race, actually. It's easier in the brake because you can ride it steady, but that was another nice reason to get up the road. But in the bunch, it's just, if you're not in the first like 30 guys, you're chasing out of every corner, chasing up climbs. And it's just really relentless. And you have to do all these like max efforts. Like it's only like 3-4 minute max efforts, but to repeat it like 8 times is just, yeah. At some point your legs are going to explode, but the best guys can keep going. So no, it makes for a really, every year it makes for a really exciting race, I think.
You mentioned you ride from altitudes. Are you one of the guys who likes it or not?
I don't like it when I'm there, but it seems to work for me when I've come back down. So in that sense, it seems really worthwhile. But yeah, when I'm having to trudge around for a couple of weeks feeling shit, it's a bit miserable.
I mean, it's renowned as being incredibly boring. Is that it? Is it just the nothing to do at night time? Is it?
Yeah, I mean, it is boring. But then also, like, you sort of feel shit on the bike, which is day-to-day motivation. Takes a bit of a slump if you're always feeling a bit shit training. And usually you're in this, like, super... Well, training camps can be pretty focused, but this is, like, where we're stuck in a hotel on the side of a hill. You're eating the same buffet food every day. Normally limited, quite underwhelming buffet food. So you just sort of got to really just, like, disconnect from enjoyment and just get on with it, in a way. Just get it done.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah. I mean, there's little things, you know, get stuck into a series. I've got a few little computer games on my laptop and I'll start smashing away on them. But generally speaking, yeah, it's not the best 2 weeks to spend with your life.
Then the next race we'll look at is Romandy, 14th on GC, which was nice and solid considering the level of rider that was there. Yeah. But I want to talk about the time trial, 23rd, which, you know, not top 10 or anything, but for me it was a point where you really kind of stepped up on the time trial bike and kind of showed maybe what you're capable of doing in the future. Looked like maybe of a new position on the bike as well.
Yeah. One of the top three worst looking positions, I've been told.
The crouching tiger. The crouching tiger, as I like to call it.
Yeah.
Not as bad as Dan Martin's, but you know, it's close.
Still bad, yeah. It's more about the end product than the way it's done with that one. No, you're right. I mean, I had a huge, huge strain with the change with the TT this year in terms of performance, but I did some aero testing in Valencia, December 2018, and it just whacked my bars way up high. There's this rule with the UCI where you have to be 5 centimeters behind the cranks or less than 105 centimeters from saddle to handlebars. I think that's right. So I'd always had it 5 centimeters on the dot behind the cranks. Then I could have my 175 centimeters out front thinking I needed it more or less. And then the guy who did the aero testing just sort of said like, well, why do you need to be 5 centimeters behind the crank? You don't look comfortable on the bike. You look all like heads poking up and you're all over the place. We'll just put you like 2 or 3 centimeters behind the cranks, whatever it is, and just force yourself to you know, just, you're going to have to squeeze up front basically. That was more or less what he said. So like, the bars came nearer, the saddle went nearer to the cranks, and it's a bit of a, doesn't look pretty because I'm all a bit, squished, but effectively I can get a narrow position and get better power out because I'm a lot higher. And so, yeah, I had a big, big change, and Romandy was the first place I saw that where I got, you know, I was amazingly happy with that. That was a big, big deal to me. To finish the stage race where there was a crash, stage 3 or 4, I don't know if you remember, and I lost like 30 or 40 seconds there.
That's right, on the uphill finish.
Yeah. And if I hadn't lost that time, because I was, stuck in behind, it was Brambier and sprinter from Colbrelli. Yeah, that would have been me. That would have been another top 10. So little things like that, you know, showing their consistency. That one didn't quite work out. But yeah, the TT put me in a position where I leapfrogged a couple more guys and still did a nice result.
and you took home the Northwest of England Time Trial Championship that day.
I did. I did. I put away Carthy. Thanks for remembering that. Huh?
He was proper gutted, I think.
I think he was. Well, I think he was just a bit shocked at that moment, to be honest. He considers himself a proper old school tester. He's been doing club tens for years, and I'm a bit new on the scene, so he wasn't happy about that, but that's all right.
The position you talked about, you do look really small from the front.
Yeah.
And it does look incredibly uncomfortable. I suppose it's like, what, half hour effort, you know, just how horrible is it? You know, is it just one of those things you just need to get through it?
It's not that bad, to be honest. It just looks weird. It's mainly because I'm so high that I've just got my, like, shoulders coming up to my ears. So basically, like, to compensate for being high, you just sort of shrug everything. But in the end, you feel the pain in your legs, not scrunching your shoulders. So it becomes very irrelevant.
Okay, we'll go to the Giro next. So you arrive there, talking down GC, your first Grand Tour. Yeah. It was a Giro. It was a huge race. It was a huge deal. Loads of top riders. Yeah. We start with the time trial in San Luca. Beautiful time trial. You go 22nd, which was
very good.
Bloody impressive up that hill.
Yeah.
What was that stage like? The fans just looked awesome.
Yeah, that was special, actually. Start of my first Grand Tour, of course. Somewhere where, having done a couple of years racing in Emilia-Romagna with Zappis back in the day, it was, felt kind of special to be back there. And yeah, it's just a special course. It was just so many, well, the fans in the Giro are pretty crazy. I mean, I've not been to the Tour, but that for me was still now thinking about it just about the most. So there's hundreds and hundreds of people at the start line, and then I thought that was enough. But then you turn up the, well, just over 2K, the San Luca climb, and it's just full noise. It was just mental. But it was a really, really hard TT, actually, because it was like you had to go as fast and efficient as you could on the flat and then basically finish with a 6-7 minute all-out VO2. I was over the line. I was really, really, I remember like the pins and needles, jittery, no, like, yeah, the all-out effort.
Did you change bikes?
No. No, I don't think you can afford to change bikes there.
You put away some big names on that as well, you?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I very happy with, that was a good, ride.
So then you, obviously, you're into the first Grand Tour, you've netted a fairly good result. Then you crash. What stage was it you crashed?
I'm pretty sure I crashed back to back. So was it maybe like something like stages 5 and 6 or something like that?
Straight away, it's total change. So obviously your crash wasn't particularly nice. You were in quite a bit of pain after it. Mentally, obviously you're only days into your first Grand Tour. That must have been quite tough to deal with, that switch of the excitement of racing the Giro to crashing, being sore, hanging about the back.
Yeah, I guess you just sort of go into survival mode at that point. You know, the team were great with me, and even though we had Elia there going for stage wins, he sort of basically took me to a side and said, we just need you to take it as easy as possible, try and get this right. I was fortunate in the sense that at that moment in time, we had quite a few, unfortunately they were quite long, but like flat days to a rest day time trial. So it seemed to be like there was this sort of end game of like, well, if I can make it there, I've got a rest day, take this TT steady, and there's a chance it'll be okay. It was a bit of a niggly issue, really, because it wasn't like, it was just all impact based from the crash, and the swelling was just causing a lot of discomfort, but I could ride easy on it. So all these days I was sort of tricking myself into thinking, oh, I'm going to be all right, I'm going to be all right, I'm riding around. And then I pulled a pin, 10K to go, whenever it was, whenever it got hard, and I didn't need to push on the pedals too much, but I couldn't really get out of the saddle, I couldn't really put any weight through it, and if I did have to go hard, then it did hurt. But basically I just delayed the inevitable by riding on it, but you know, I had to try. But yeah, as was to be, I didn't really get any better, and I hit the first proper mountain day, and it was, yeah, it was pretty much impossible to go uphill with it slugging away.
At that point, you know, are you gutted, devastated, or is it just, can you play it off as just one of those things that happens in cycling?
Yeah, I was pretty devastated. It was sort of nice though, because I was still discussing it with the team day by day, and it's hard for anyone to appreciate what pain you're experiencing. But at that point, the doctor just said to me, like, you're done, it's over, you're not starting tomorrow, which in a way was sort of like a relief, because I sort of you know, I was floating around in no man's land at this point, having done like 6 or 7 days with a sore knee. So I'm to, you know, rack up 200k days, slogging away, sort of getting through, taking a paracetamol and ibuprofen by the start, packing it with clay every night, hoping that would help, you know, all these random stuff just to like keep going the next day, keep going and keep going. But then in my head, I think I was mentally over it anyway. You know, I sort of think I guessed that, you know, this is still not getting better. So yeah, it was kind of maybe a little bit of relief by the time I got there, because it did take so long. You know, it was a week riding around, just sort of like, what am I doing? But it's a difficult sport for that, isn't it? Because guys do, you know, from the start of a Grand Tour to the end of a Grand Tour, you can be a different man. You know, if you get ill in the first week, you can be fresh and ready to go in the last week. So you've always got to try and bear that in mind. But yeah, it's not an easy part of the sport.
Then you had almost like a total reset, mid-season reset. Obviously, you had to go and recover from your injury. You were away from racing for about 2 months. So proper break, which obviously is quite unusual. Did it give you a chance just to almost disconnect and just forget about stuff?
Yeah. No, it's a bit of a luxury to have, but it can be, I think it can be a big deal really for having two proper parts of the season. You know, I mean, that was maybe longer than need be, having had like 2-3 weeks completely off the bike with the knee and then getting back into it. But to actually completely walk away, I had a bit of a holiday, you know, complete downtime, not thinking about anything, not worrying about when I'm going to come back, and then being able to get back on the bike and get everything back into everything nice and slowly. Still plenty of time, because it is, even if it's 2 months off, there's still, you know, 3 months of good racing to go. So it's not exactly like, you know, I still racked up like 75 days of racing in the end. So I wasn't like I missed out hugely.
You returned to Adriatica fairly successfully, took a third place. Again, that must have boosted the confidence.
Yeah, it did. I turned up really with no expectation. Like you said, I'd had that big break. I'd had 2 months off. We had a team camp in Livigno for like 16, 17 days before that, which is we do every year with the team, or every year I've been on the team, we do that whilst the Tour de France is on. And really sort of floated around, rolled back into it, just getting back into the swing of training. Yeah, and then turned up already at Adriatica without anything, you know, no serious specification to be there, a good shape. Was already, yeah, going pretty well. Like you say, third place, smaller race, but still really nice to be right in the mix of it.
Then you go Tour of Poland, and then another kind of milestone. Your first top 10 world tour in Europe, and that was a tough race. I mean, I know you mentioned UAE Tour there, which was eighth, and that was really good. But you've told it as it is. It's two 25-minute efforts, whereas Tour of Poland's fairly grim at times.
Yeah, it was really hard, actually. I wasn't expecting Poland to be so hard. Was it like stage 5, the first hilly day? Was just all out all day. Was it 2 hard days or 3 hard days? I can't remember. Was one neutralised?
One was neutralised, which was the kind of uphill kick. There was one, which was the lap circuit that Mezgech took the win, but that wasn't really that hard.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think there was the two kind of GC days.
That's right, that's right. And the two GC days were just bonkers hard. Yeah, they were just rolling around every time we went uphill, we're basically going eyeballs out. Yeah, it was really good racing, actually, from like just, it was like hammer series, but for 3 times as long. It was just like, what are we doing here? We're just going full gas nonstop for the whole day for like 160K. But yeah, no, I realized that was a good level there. I was really dead on the last day, but I'm sort of clipped across that winning move on the second to last day and then got dropped as soon as I got across. It was a bit of a shame. Just made a huge effort to get across and then we hit the last climb
and
I was
up.
Yeah. Oh well. But yeah, I managed to salvage that top 10. Another, like you say, another good milestone. Finding there for those GC positions, sort of cementing my place as a bit of a GC rider. So
then you head to Vuelta. Second Grand Tour, you know, almost experienced at this now. How does the Vuelta feel compared to the Giro? I've heard many times it's totally different, much more relaxed. Is it?
Yeah, it is. It's a nice race for me anyway, particularly as a rider, just sort of, I don't know, it's got all the feeling like the riders, every rider who's there, you know, is taking it seriously and is going for the win and everything, but then at the same time, there doesn't seem to be this like added pressure of everyone's year depends on it, if that makes sense. So no one's like really risking it. No one's lining up to be at the front for no reason at 100k to go, like I sort of found at the Giro, which was sort of mind-boggling when you just drag racing for no reason with, you know, 50, 60, 70k to go from the finish line. But yeah, everyone goes for the win, but no one goes like, we're going to be completely stupid about this. So in many ways, it's a great race to be at where you can just do your race, get stuck in, don't really feel like you're risking your life every stage.
So you're going okay, you're posting some decent results, and then we have the epic day in the Crosswinds, which probably will go down in history as one of the days in Grand Tours. From the gun, as soon as the car pulls away, you and the boys in blue just rip it, and it splits immediately. What's your memories of that day?
Wow, now it's really special thinking about it.
Was it the plan to go from the gun?
Not really. We just presumed that, you know, it was had to be there in front, or there was a good chance it was going to be split. So I was just a bag of nerves, to be honest, on the starting line, absolutely petrified that I've been slogging away now for 16 days, finally up to like something. I think maybe then I was like a top 15, could have been like a 12th or 13th or something on GC. So in a good, fairly good position, really, pretty respectable. I was pretty happy where I got myself up to at this point in time. So yeah, I was just scared shitless, thinking like, this is it. This is 220K, 120K of which are just like 40K an hour crosswind. And it was this weird atmosphere on the start line where everyone was in sort of denial that anyone was going to do anything about it. Oh, no, we're not going to go. No, it's too long. Let's not worry about it. And then, like you say, I was so nervous. I got myself onto the lead car, sort of barged a few of the big lads out of the way because I was just like panicking. I would just be getting myself in prime position. And so the lead car's pulling off as they always do for kilometer zero, make, you know, an acceleration just to get away from the bunch. But instead, they got the entire bunch still sprinting on the bonnet of this car. So we're all coming into like kilometer zero, like 70K an hour, coming out of this town. 30, 40k an hour crosswinds, and just everyone's piled straight up into the right-hand gutter. And after like a few minutes of like going full gas, suddenly we're here. Oh, everyone's in front, keep going. And that was basically it. It just didn't let off. It was just all out. It was just non-stop, full gas. We started off with like 50 guys in front, and one by one, everyone's like, the guys started popping, big names started popping out the front. And then we had to do this, last 160k or so of just 30 or so guys turning in front with, 7 out of 8, the Kunnik Quickstep guys there. Which was pretty remarkable, actually, when you think about it.
For a lot of people, that's the special bit. You know, team of 8, and you have 7 guys at the front. And as you said, a number of guys were popped fairly early, but you kept as a 7, and you guys were riding. There was nobody sitting on, and you kept like that. I think, was it Jakobsen was the first go? On a little kind of, well, I would say little. You've been riding full gas for...
It were pretty hard, right? That's actually another reason that we got the fastest ever race over 200 kilometers, and it was like 2,500 meters of climbing that day. It was pretty up and down. These were some nasty little climbs there. And the worst thing was, like, we go up the climb at a steady pace. It's like classic Spanish roads of hit the top and then plateau over the top. So as soon as you hit the top, it was just lined out in the gutter again. So you do 5 minutes full gas, more or less, for the climb. Nothing more, really, than 5 minutes. Just to be put in the gutter at 60k an hour instantly. So it was really, really hard riding, And eventually, Jakobsen and Capecchi, they both blew at the same time, I think. And we only had maybe 40k to go from that point, and it was just a big tailwind. We had De Klerk, Cavagna, Aviti, and Oliveira just churning away at the front. I think Aviti might have had like a 56 or a 58 on or something crazy, and they're just plowing away. We did crazy speed,
How much talk was in the ear? I mean, obviously, we're sitting watching it on the TV. We can see that the front group are working really well. We can see that every other group is just utter chaos. Valverde's attacking. You know, it's just, it's chaos behind. Was that information fed to you guys that, you know, just they're in pieces behind you, just go?
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty chaotic, because even the best jobs of the DS is sending through information to us. We still, you know, you couldn't really understand what was going on. We were hearing groups are all over the road. Yeah, leader's jersey, 4 minutes, 5 minutes behind, then coming back to 4 minutes and going out to 5 minutes. But sort of like funny thing looking back now, which is how much stress was in the front from, I mean, obviously it's stressful riding the crosswind stage, but we were riding such a good race, but it really felt like it was like panic stations from kilometer zero. We were just sort of, I was losing my cool, the riders losing their cool, screaming in the radio, you need to ride, so who's going to sit on? And it was just basically just sort of like, yeah, 4 hours of just the biggest stress you can imagine. But everyone at the same time still going 60k an hour, rolling through, sort of shouting at each other, getting on with it. And then, yeah, it finished off pretty well. We could all laugh and joke about it afterwards. But at the time, there were some pretty heated words going from different members of the team to each other.
I think I remember Tim DeClercq giving somebody a right heels. He just launched it. I can't actually remember who it was at. He just lost his cool.
Could have been anyone, yeah. No, I think everyone was pretty heated there.
So then you get into the finale, and it's a kind of flat-ish finish. Your sprinter's been dropped. Sam Bennett's there. You've got Gilbert, you've got Stibar, you've got Cavagna. What was the chat? There must have been a plan made by the DS or by the guys themselves. When did that happen?
I think we were talking into that. Well, at some point in the stage, we'd all sort of said, we're going to try and save Phil and Stevie a bit. Phil, I think maybe a bit more of a priority, because at that point he'd already won a stage, hadn't he? So we sort of knew his legs were good, sort of showing himself already, before Stevie had finished second on that other little finish. So I guess we had more belief there in Phil. He started sitting in the wheels, then Fabio dropped. And then we're coming into that finish, and there was a bit of talk between, well, I think Stevie and Phil did a lot of talking between themselves. But Phil came to me at like 10k to go and saying I needed to go like as soon as we hit this last, because what was it, like 2.5k, approximately, of like little kick into drag into little kick into drag sort of thing. Wanted me to go full gas, and I remember him sort of saying like, oh no, I can't. I just can't. I'm really sorry. I don't want to let the team down, but I'm going to get dropped in the wheel at this rate sort of thing. So yeah, they must have then. I guess the only thing we had at that moment was that Sam was alone. Bennett was on his own, I'm pretty sure. So yeah, took the decision to, between themselves, like I'm not saying, you know, it was really at that moment out of hand of like the DSs or any of the riders. Phil and Stibar were the guys with the hands to play, and they played it. Stevie went long on the chance that people start looking at each other, but they did ride him down. In the end, Sam went early and Phil could come over the top of him. So it worked out, but well, it was still not really, wasn't exactly set up for, despite having done all the, or had the numbers, especially couldn't have been pinging guys off at 10K, which is too much of a, you know, impossible in the tailwind. Everyone was pretty gassed as well, so it was a really tough one to actually finish off as well. And I've got to say, like, Phil was a bit of a killer there. He showed his instincts that, you know, real fox has. You can just wait, believe in himself, and, yeah, do the business.
Now, you roomed with Gilbert at the Vuelta, didn't you? What, just, did you manage to get some of that experience out of him?
I mean, it's really difficult to get the sort of, yeah, you're not going to learn the craft and the experience of a man like that who's been on the scene for 18, 19 years, but it was still a real honour to be in the room with him. I guess I learned a lot just in the sort of the mentality and the character he has, you know, every single day. Every single day he's going for the, you know, wants to win, wants to be involved in the race. He's just a racer as well. So like for him rolling around for 4 hours and not getting to do anything, it's just a disappointment. It's just a waste of a day. So just wants to be chomping at the bit, be it helping, you know, Fabio win or going for his own. And yeah, in that respect. And also what he brings to the team as well, like such a big personality. He was able to ride the highs and the lows, but keep everyone in good spirits, and yeah, make the whole experience for everyone. For the whole 3 weeks, you know, kept the morale high. And that's a huge amount of admiration for that, because you don't have guys like that in the team. It's difficult, isn't it?
And then from the highs to the lows, so you're on track for top 10. You've maintained your performance all the way through. And then what was it? Third day to go, fourth day to go, the big crash. You hit the ground hard. Did you know at that point that you probably were going to drop out of things?
Yeah, I was pretty concerned. I don't know. Again, I was just in, yeah, said it before, I guess I was just in real survival mode. Sort of turned up on that stage 20, not knowing if I could. I think I was like a crash stage 19, managed to get through the end of stage 19, back when it was all a mess in the crosswinds, and then eventually luckily they slowed up and I got back in. And then, yeah, stage 20, sort of realised the damage had set in. But then, yeah, that night I was stiff and sore, knees and elbows and hips. Everything had taken a real battering. The adrenaline had worn off, and the pain had set in. I was pretty bashed up, to be honest. I was not in a good way in terms of feelings. And yeah, stage 20 was just awful. It was wet, cold, huge day in the mountains in the end. I think it was like the biggest elevation day we did of the whole Vuelta, which was not needed. And I just couldn't really give any more than I did. But yeah, Phil and Stevie stayed with me and dragged me around the whole time. So pretty easy to be disappointed about the top 10, but I was pretty happy just to make it through and come away with a 11th at that moment.
21 seconds. I mean, you think about everything and it can be a cruel sport at times. But what was that experience like that day? I mean, you mentioned that there, Stibar and Gilbert stayed with you the whole way. I think there was footage of you. You couldn't even get your jacket on or off, and they're trying to help you with that maybe the previous day. And it, like, I feel like, although it didn't turn out to be a happy story in the end, you know, it's a fairly epic tale to be able to tell.
Yeah. Well, I don't look on it with any sort of like bad memories or anything like that. You know, that is also the sport, the suffering that goes with it, you know, it is epic. It is pretty, at the time it is awful. I don't remember thinking any sort of like any real appreciation of what was going on at the time. I was just really sort of just buried deep into my own little hurt locker trying to get through. But yeah, they are, you know, amazing memories now, and it is pretty bewildering to sort of say that, yeah, you know, two of the best bike riders in the world, Steve R and Gilbert, hauling me around for the last, I think it was maybe like 80K on that stage 20, just to get me over the line, just to try and salvage a top 10 on GC, when they quite could have easily said, you know, this kid's done here, you know, let's not even worry about top 10, let's just, you know, ride our own race, or hopefully can get to the finish sort of thing. So yeah, no, it is really crazy to think about it. And just, you know, just to be involved in a bit of drama in the sport as well, I guess that's nice, having grown up being a fan and felt like I was not putting on a show, so to speak, but, you know, part of one of the biggest, had a bit of a narrative in one of the biggest races of the season, and did my bit to be trying to involve in the action. And yeah, just missed out on a top 10 in GC was also pretty staggering as well, because felt like I'd come a huge way in one season to be disappointed about not getting top 10 in a Grand Tour when I started it, sort of just hoping to finish.
And you also became a Eurosport celebrity on the TV almost every day, getting interviewed by the Eurosport boys. You took to it quite well.
Yeah, no. I hadn't really done any TV interviews before that, so it was okay. It was okay. The team there are pretty amazing for making you feel at home, so in the end, it became quite natural. I think, yeah, I did like 3 or 4, chipped in my little bit of the day, made it short and snappy. I don't know, I got a lot of messages in the end, so it felt, yeah, that was also a nice part of it. Felt like I was being appreciated for having a bit of a chat on the end of the day, so wasn't exactly a big deal. It was a lot easier than having to slug around for 4 or 5 hours on the bike anyway.
So you got a contract extension this year, another 2 years. When did that happen? When did you sign that contract?
I signed it in Livigno. I think basically Patrick just gave me a nod and a wink from maybe like UAE. He was there at the race and just sort of said, "Well, there's a place for you on the team if you, you know, if you want to be part of this team, there's going to be a place for you." Something, and I want to be part of the team, and that was basically it. It took a while for all the sort of contract business to come through, but I think that was kind of standard, just because Patrick had far bigger fish to deal with. You know, he had a lot of big stars come in and go in, and all that is real time, money and effort to sort out. And I was more just of a, here you go, here's what we can offer you. And I was going to be very happy with what I got. So just have 2 more years with the team, though. I think it's really turning out to be a perfect place to develop. And I'm really happy in the environment and everything as well.
I mean, you're riding for, without a shadow of a doubt, the best cycling team in the world. They have some of the biggest names in cycling on their team, yet they seem at ease at offering young guys like yourself the chance to ride and chase personal results. You know, they are fairly good, they're brilliant at developing young talent. Like, I'm thinking Cavagna this season, or Jakobsen, or Hodge. Yeah. I mean, they seem to have this amazing knack at being able to manage you guys really well. Yeah. What... You know, how does it feel to ride for such a...
Just year by year, though, there's so many, isn't there? Because there's Massa's left, Chapman's left, Gaviria's left. Yeah, there's a crazy amount of guys who come to the team and turn themselves into world-class riders in the time that they're here, and don't really know what the secret is, to be honest. Seems to be just like a lovely, easy atmosphere where everyone's pretty determined to prove themselves, and sort of business model that Patrick's employed of making sure he consistently gives young guys an opportunity and not really sort of refusing to overpay or bring in the big names. He's just kept like a constant cycle of like, I think, yeah, even now, like it feels younger and younger guys on there on the team. You know, there's already like another 5 or 6 new guys who have joined this team who are all younger than me. And you're like, whoa, okay. A lot of guys now are already younger than me, but they're all going to be just as willing to prove themselves over the next couple of years as I am. And that cycle just keeps pushing everyone forward because there's still the top names and everyone's trying to be at their level as well. So yeah, no, it's really, really special, isn't it? You know, I can't really, yeah, have to sort of step back and appreciate it.
I mean, and you can't comment on this, no doubt, but other teams seem to have a bit of a scattergun approach when it comes to signings. Quickstep seem to nail it. You know, not only this season, I'm sure everybody will be looking at the fact they've gone and signed Sam Bennett.
Yeah.
Shane Archibald's come with him. But, you know, they've identified the fact they need some more domestics. So they've gone and signed Stijn Steels, Bert van Leerbecker, you know.
Yeah.
Add that into De Klerk. You've got big, strong guys. And it's not just about signing the Evenepoels. Yeah. You know, they seem to have a real clear idea of where they need to kind of boost.
You're right, because they seem to have appreciation as well. Like, they seem to be one of the few teams that really have appreciation of like getting guys in for the lead out instead of just getting a sprinter. You know, like, I know Stijn and Bert are going to be hopefully involved in, you know, I'm not really my business, but talks have been about part of that as well. And then, so yeah, there's more support in there for the sprinters. And yeah, I mean, I'd love to know what goes on behind the scenes in terms of signings, because I guess I sort of scratched my head a little bit when I got the chance to join the team. Like, did I feel like it was I lucky? Was I just in the right place at the right moment? Or was it really like this team wanted me? It's really hard to know just how everything fell into place in a way, because you're sort of unaware of what's going on behind the scenes. Now, every year, there's not really, can't really think of anyone who's been a bad signing. It all just seems to, everyone just seems to step up to the level that they need to be on this team.
And the opposite is true. Very few leave and go on to do better things.
True, true. It certainly becomes hard, doesn't it, when you see guys stepping away to be at the same level.
Okay, 2020, feeling stronger, no doubt. You've completed a grand tour. You will undoubtedly get a nice bounce in your legs, possibly a bit of a bigger engine. How do you feel now compared to this time last year? Do you feel any different?
I don't know. It's so long ago that I can't really remember, if I'm being honest. Yeah, maybe feel a bit stronger, a bit heavier than normal, but won't worry about that just yet. But just sort of been ticking over, doing the same things, bits in the gym, little bits of running, starting to rack up a few miles in the bank, on the bike. And I guess I'll only know by the time we sort of get to February, March time, whether it's another step forward or more of the same. I really don't know. It's really, we did a test at the start of the camp, and apparently it was good, but more or less the same, to be honest. You know, I had a little bit less time back onto the bike this year before the camp than I had previously. So really, with all those things, when you're juggling all those different aspects of it, it's hard to know, you know, am I stronger or am I just, you know, lacking a couple more weeks on the bike?
And can you give us a sneak peek into the race program for the next season? Have you had any discussions?
Yeah. There's been plenty of discussions, and it looks like I'm going to follow a pretty similar plan to last year. Probably won't be heading to Australia, maybe start in Spain at Valencia and then follow up towards the Giro like last year.
Cool. And it's nearly Christmas time, so some festive questions. You know, what do you get a professional cyclist for Christmas?
Yeah, I don't really ask much for Christmas. I don't know.
Do you get cycling-related presents?
Yeah, I need a new frame pump, so my dad's getting me a frame pump. My old one, after 2 or 3 years of good usage, I think it got that much water in the head that one of the bits rusted and it just completely fell apart, so a new frame pump is well-deserved. Oh, I get my mum and my granny to, most of the time, I've just moved to Andorra now, but most of the time I've been in Spain for the last year and now Andorra, and they've got a severe lacking of spices. So I'll get my mum and granny to chip in and buy me some nice little mixed spice, but you know, some fancy UK, you know, the real showing off like spice selections, just to spicing up Waitrose. A bit of curry. Yeah, cooking at home.
Did they nip down to the local Waitrose for you?
Booze, mate. Good old booze in the northwest. I don't know. I don't know where they get them from, but it goes well. Even just some like Patak's curry paste. They just go down a treat. They're the sort of things you miss.
Last question. Is being a professional cyclist what you thought it would be?
Oh, good question. Good question. I'm going to try not to waffle too much. I guess it's not what I thought it was. Or what it was going to be. I had the 2 years on Zappies, and we were led by hardened ex-cyclist, ex-professional cyclist Flavio Zappi. And I think he led out such a scary example of the sacrifices that needed to be made, be it right or wrong, or how it was in his day, or just like bed every night at 10 p.m. Strict, super strict diet every single day of your life. Training rigorous and to the dot. I just thought, this is, you know, like, you know, I got on with it and we did it and we were part of a team living together. And it sort of became normal, but it was still like really crazy at the time. And I think that prepared me for such a like level of excessiveness and obsessiveness that by the time I actually got to the team here with Quickstep, and, you know, even though it's such a successful team, there's still a really quite general laid back attitude and sort of everyone does the training, but everyone can enjoy a drink. Everyone can stuff the face at the buffet, and everyone just sort of, you know, realize, well, it's kind of different, isn't it, when you're making 10, 15 years careers and just chasing a professional contract, so you can't be completely crazy the whole time. But yeah, to sort of see that environment and then realize that sometimes going like all the way to the extreme isn't really necessarily beneficial, be it your health, be it your performance, or just, yeah, generally your well-being as a person, to actually slowly come back to normality in a way and just actually go like, this is the training I need to do, need to be fueled for the training, need to generally be concerned about my weight and everything and being ready for races, but not completely like going absolutely crazy day in, day out. It was giving me sort of, I guess, an appreciation of the sport as a whole and how lucky I am to be here and doing what I love. But yeah, no, it's, I guess I'm saying it's better than I expected.
Interesting. So a really harsh lesson at the start is exactly what we need.
Yeah, just take it way too far at the start. And then after that, everything appears to be easier.
Brilliant. Okay, James Knox, thank you very much for giving up your time from the Calpe team camp.
No problem.
And I'm sure everybody wishes you a cracking 2020.
Thank you very much, and Merry Christmas and Happy New Year's to any listeners. See you 2020.